Victorian Periodical Parade.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Victorian Periodical Parade. We'll just keep going. This week, I'm going to be reading Chapter 7, Lady Audley's Secret again. We're going to be following George Talboys and his adventures. So let's have a sip and continue on to everything. Chapter 7, After a Year. The first year of George Talboys' widowhood passed away. The deep band of crepe around his hat grew brown and rusty. And as the last burning day of another August faded out, he sat smoking cigars in the quiet chambers in Fig Tree Court, much as he had done the year before when the horror of his grief was new to him. And every object in life, however trifling or however important, seemed to saturate with his one great sorrow. But the big ex-dragoon had survived his affliction by a 12-month, and hard as it may be to have to tell it, he did not look much the worse for it. Heaven knows what inner change may have been worked by the bitter disappointment. Heaven knows what wasted agonies of remorse and self-reproach may not have racked George's honest heart as he lay awake at night. Thinking of the wife he had abandoned in the pursuit of a fortune which she never lived to share. Once, while they were abroad, Robert Audley ventured to congratulate him upon his recovered spirits. He burst into a bitter laughter. "Do you know, Bob," he said, "that when some of our fellows were wounded in India, they came home bringing bullets inside them. They did not talk of them, and they were stout and hardy, and looked as well, perhaps, as you or I, but every change in the weather, however slight, every variation of the atmosphere, however trifling, brought back the old agony of the wounds as sharp as ever they had felt it on the battlefield. I've had my wound, Bob. I carry the bullet still, and I shall carry it into my coffin." The travelers returned from St. Petersburg in the spring, and George again took up his quarters in his old friend's chambers, only leaving them now and then to run down to Southampton and take a look at his little boy. He always went loaded with toys and sweetmints to give to the child. But for all this, Georgery would not become very familiar with his papa, and the young man's heart sickened as he began to fancy that even his child was lost to him. "What can I do?" he thought. "If I take him away from his grandfather, I shall break his heart. If I let him remain, he will grow up a stranger to me, and care more for that drunken old hypocrite than for his own father. But then, what could an ignorant, heavy dragoon like me do with such a child? What could I teach him except to smoke cigars and idle about all day with his hands in his pockets?" So the anniversary of that 30th of August, upon which George had seen the advertisement of his wife's death in the Times newspaper, came round for the first time, and the young man put off his black clothes and shabby crepe from his hat and laid his mourning garments in a trunk in which he had kept a pack of his wife's letters and that lock of hair which had been cut from her head after death. Robert Audley had never seen either the letters or the long tress of silky hair, nor indeed had George ever mentioned the name of his dead wife after that day at Vetnor, on which he learned all the full particulars of her decease. "I shall to my cousin Alicia write today, George," the young barista said upon the very 30th of August. "Do you know the day after tomorrow is the 1st of September? I shall write and tell her that we will be both down to the court for a week's shooting."
"No, no, Bob, go by yourself. They don't want me, and I'd rather..."
"Bury yourself in Fig Tree Court with no company but my dogs and canaries? No, George, you shall do nothing of the kind."
"But I don't care for shooting."
"And do you suppose I care for it?"
cried Robert, with charming narite.
"Why, man, I don't know a partridge from a pigeon, and it might be the 1st of April instead of the 1st of September, for aught I care. I never hit a bird in my life, but I have hurt my own shoulder with the weight of my gun. I only go down to Essex for the change of air, the good dinners, and the sight of my uncle's honest, handsome face. Besides, this time I've another inducement, as I want to see this fair-haired paragon, my new aunt. You'll go with me, George?"
"Yes, if you really wish it." The quiet form which his grief had taken after its first brief violence left him, as submissive as a child to the will of his friend, ready to go anywhere or do anything, never enjoying himself or originating any enjoyment, but joining in the pleasures of others with a hopeless, quiet, uncomplaining, unobtrusive resignment peculiar to his simple nature. But the return of post brought a letter from Alicia Audley to say that the two young men could not be received at the court.
"There are 17 spare bedrooms," wrote the young lady in an indignant, running hand. "But for all that, my dear Robert, you can't come, for my lady has taken it into her silly head that she is too ill to entertain visitors. There is no more the matter with her than there is with me, and she cannot have gentlemen, great rough men, she says, in the house. Please apologize to your friend, Mr. Talboys, and tell him that Papa hopes to see you both in the hunting season.
My lady's airs and graces shan't keep us out of the Essex for all that,"
said Robert, as he twisted the letter from a pipelight for his big meerschaum.
"I'll tell you what we'll do, George. There's a glorious fun at Audley and plenty of fishing in the neighborhood. We'll go there and have a week's sport. Fishing is much better than shooting. You've only got to lie on a bank and stare at your line. I don't find that you often catch anything, but it's very pleasant."
He held the twisted letter to the feeble spark of fire glimmering in the grate as he spoke, and then, changing his mind, deliberately unfolded it and smoothed the crumpled paper with his hand.
"Poor little Alicia," he said thoughtfully.
"It's rather hard to treat her letters so cavalierly. I'll keep it."
Upon which Mr. Robert Audley put the note back into its envelope and afterwards thrust it into a pigeonhole in his office desk marked "Important." Heaven knows what wonderful documents there were in this particular pigeonhole, but I do not think it likely to have contained anything of great judicial value. If anyone could at that moment have told the young barrister that so simple a thing as his cousin's brief letter would one day come to be the link in that terrible chain of evidence afterwards to be slowly forged in the one only criminal case in which he was ever to be concerned, perhaps Mr. Robert Audley would have lifted his eyebrows a little higher than usual. So the two young men left London the next day with one portmanteau and a rod and tackle between them, and reached the straggling, old-fashioned, fast-decaying village of Audley in time to order a good dinner at the Sun Inn. Audley Court was about 3/4 mile from the village, lying, as I have said, deep down in a hollow, shut in by luxuriant timber. You could only reach it by a cross road, bordered by trees, and as trimly kept as the avenues in a gentleman's park. It was a dreary place enough, even in all its rustic beauty, for so bright a creature as the late Miss Lucy Graham. But the generous baronet had transformed the interior of the grey old mansion into a little palace for his young wife, and Lady Audley seemed to be as happy as a child surrounded by new and costly toys. In her better fortunes as in her old days of dependence, wherever she went, she seemed to smile and bring gladness with her, in spite of Miss Alicia's undistinguished contempt for her stepmother's childishness and frivolity. Lucy was better loved and more admired than the baronet's daughter. That very childishness had a charm which few could resist. The innocence and candor of an infant beamed in Lady Audley's fair face and shone out of her large and liquid blue eyes. The rosy lips, the delicate nose, the profusion of fair ringlets all contributed to preserve her beauty, the character of extreme youth and freshness. She owned to 20 years of age, but it was hard to believe her more than 17. Her fragile figure, which she loved to dress in heavy velvets and stiff, rustling silks, still she looked like a child tricked out for a masquerade, was as girlish as if she had just left the nursery. All her amusements were childish. She hated reading or study of any kind and loved society. Rather than be alone, she would admit Phoebe Marks into her confidence and loll on one of the sofas in her luxurious dressing room, discussing a new costume for some coming dinner party, or sit chattering to the girl with her jewelry box beside her open upon the satin cushions, and Sir Michael's presents spread out in her lap, while she counted and admired her treasures. She had appeared at several public balls and at Chelmsford and Colchester, and was immediately established as the belle of the county. Pleased with her high position and her handsome house, with every caprice gratified, every whim indulged, admired, and caressed,
wherever she went, fond of her generous husband, rich in a noble allowance of pin money, and no poor relations to worry her with claims upon her purse or patronage. It would have been hard to find this county of Essex a more fortunate creature than lucky Lady Audley. The two young men loitered over the dinner table in the private sitting room at the Sun Inn. The windows were thrown wide open and the fresh country air blew in upon them as they dined. The weather was lovely, the foliage of the woods touched here and there with faint gleams of the earliest hints of autumn. The yellow corn still standing in some of the fields, in others just falling under the shining sickle, while in the narrow lanes you met great wagons drawn by broad-chested cart horses carrying home the rich golden store. To anyone who has been during the hot summer months penned up in London, there is the first taste of rustic life, a kind of sensuous rapture scarcely to be described. George Talboys felt this, and in this he experienced the nearest approach to enjoyment that he had ever known since his wife's death. The clock struck 5 as they finished dinner.
"Put on your hat, George," said Robert Audley. "They don't dine at the court till 7. We shall have time to stroll down and see the old place and its inhabitants."
The landlord, who had come into the room with a bottle of wine, looked up as the young man spoke.
"I beg your pardon, Mr. Audley," he said, "but if you want to see your uncle, you'll lose your time by going to the court just now. Sir Michael and my lady and Miss Alicia have all gone to the races up at Chorley, and they won't be back till nigh upon 8 o'clock. Most likely. They must pass by here to go home."
Under these circumstances, of course, it was no use going to the court, so the two young men strolled through the village and looked at the old church, and then went and reconnoitred the streams in which they were to fish the next day, and by such means beleaguered the time till after 7 o'clock. At about 15 past the hour, they returned to the inn, and seating themselves in the open window, lit their cigars and looked out at the peaceful prospect. "We hear every day of the murders committed in the country. Brutal and treacherous murders, slow, protracted agonies from poisons administered by some kindred hand, sudden and violent deaths by cruel blows, inflicted with a stake cut from some spending oak, whose very shadow promised peace. In the country of which I write, I have been shown a meadow, in which, on a quiet summer Sunday evening, a young farmer murdered the girl who had loved and trusted him. And yet even now, with the stain of the foul deed upon it, the aspect of the spot is peace. No crime has ever been committed in the worst rookeries about 7 dials that has not been also done in the face of that sweet, rustic calm, which still, in spite of all, we look on with a tender, half-mournful yearning and associate with peace. It was dusk when gigs and chaises, dog carts and clumsy farmers' phantoms began to rattle through the village street, and under the windows of the Sun Inn, deeper dusk still, when an open carriage and 4 drew suddenly up beneath the rocking signpost. It was Sir Michael Audley's brooch which came to a sudden stop before the little inn. The harness of one of the leaders had become out of order, and the foremost postillion dismounted to set it right.
"Why, it's my uncle," cried Robert Audley as the carriage stopped. "I'll run out and speak to him."
George lit another cigar and, sheltered by the window curtains, looked out at the tiny party. Alicia sat with her back to the horses, and he could perceive, even in the dusk, that she was a handsome brunette. But Lady Audley was seated on the side of the carriage farthest from the inn, and he could see nothing of the fair-haired paragon of whom he had heard so much.
"Why, Robert," exclaimed Michael, as his nephew emerged from the inn, "this is a surprise."
"I have come to intrude upon you at the court, my dear uncle," said the young man, as the baronet shook him by the hand in his own hearty fashion. "Essex is my native country, you know, and about this time of year I generally have a touch of homesickness. So George and I have come down to the inn for 2 or 3 days fishing."
"George? George who?"
"George Talboys." "What, has he come?" cried Alicia. "I'm so glad, for I'm dying to see this handsome young widower." "Are you, Alicia?"
said her cousin.
"Then en garde. I'll run and fetch him, and introduce you to him at once."
Now so complete was the dominion which Lady Audley had, in her own childish, unthinking way, obtained over her devoted husband, that it was very rarely that the baronet's eyes were long removed from his wife's pretty face. When Robert, therefore, was about to re-enter the inn, it needed but the faintest elevation of Lucy's eyebrows, with a charming expression of weariness and terror, to make her husband aware that she did not want to be bored by any introduction to Mr. George Talboys.
"Never mind tonight, Bob," he said. "My wife is a little tired after a long day's pleasure. Bring your friend to dinner tomorrow, and then he and Alicia can make each other's acquaintance. Come round and speak to Lady Audley, and then we'll drive home."
My lady was so terribly fatigued that she could only smile sweetly and hold out a very tiny gloved hand to a nephew by marriage.
"You will come and dine with us tomorrow, and bring your interesting friend," she said in a low and tired voice.
She had been the chief attraction of the race course, and was wearied out by the exertion of fascinating half the county.
"It's a wonder she didn't treat you to her never-ending laugh,"
whispered Alicia, as she leant over the carriage door to bid Robert good night.
"But I dare say she reserves that for your declaration tomorrow. I suppose you are fascinating as well as everybody else?"
adding the young lady rather snappishly.
"She is a lovely creature, certainly,"
murmured Robert, with placid admiration.
"Oh, of course. Now, she's the first woman of whom I have ever heard you say a civil word, Robert Audley. I'm sorry to think that you can only admire wax dolls."
Poor Alicia had many skirmishes with a cousin upon the peculiar temperament of his, which, while it enabled him to go through life with perfect content and tacit enjoyment, entirely precluded his feeling one of spark of enthusiasm upon any subject whatever.
"As to his ever falling in love," thought the young lady sometimes, "the idea is too preposterous. If all the divinities upon earth were ranged before him, waiting for his suitorship to throw the handkerchief, he would only lift his eyebrows to the middle of his forehead and tell them to scramble for it."
But for once in his life, Robert was almost enthusiastic.
"She's the prettiest little creature you ever saw in your life, George,"
he cried when the carriage had driven off and he returned to his friend.
"Such blue eyes, such ringlets, such a ravishing smile, such a fairy-like bonnet, all of a tremble with heart's ease and dewy spangles, shining out of a cloud of gauze. George Talboys, I feel like the hero of a French novel. I'm falling in love with my aunt."
The widower only sighed and puffed the cigar fiercely out of the window. Perhaps he was thinking of that faraway time, little better than 5 years ago, in fact, but such an age gone by to him, when he first met the woman of whom he had worn crepe round his hat 3 days before. They returned all those old, forgotten feelings. They came back with the scene of their birthplace. Again, he lounged with his brother officers upon the shabby pier at the shabby watering place, listening to a dreary band with a cornet that was a note and a half flat. Again, he heard the old operatic airs, and again she came tripping towards him, leaning on her old father's arm and pretending with such a charming, delicious, serio-comic pretense to be listening to the music and quite unaware of the admiration of half a dozen mouth-open cavalry officers. Again, the old fancy came back that she was something too beautiful for earth or earthly muses, and that to approach her was to walk into a higher atmosphere and to breathe a purer air. And since this, she had been his wife and the mother of his child. She lay in the little churchyard at Vetnor, and only a year ago had he given the order for her tombstone. A few slow, silent tears dropped upon his waistcoat, and he thought of these things in the quiet and darkening room. Lady Audley was so exhausted when she reached home that she excused herself from the dinner table and retired at once to her dressing room, attended by her maid, Phoebe Marks. She was a little capricious in her conduct to this maid, sometimes very confidential, sometimes rather reserved, but she was a liberal mistress, and the girl had every reason to be satisfied with her situation. This evening, in spite of her fatigue, she was in extremely high spirits and gave an animated account of the races and the company present at the time.
"I am tired to death, though, Phoebe,"
she said by and by.
"I'm afraid I must look a perfect fright after a day in the hot sun."
There were lighted candles on each side of the glass before which Lady Audley was standing, unfastening her dress. She looked full at her maid as she spoke, her blue eyes clear and bright, and the rosy, childish lips puckered into an arch smile.
"You are a little pale, my lady,"
whispered the girl,
"but you look as pretty as ever." "That's right, Phoebe,"
she said, flinging herself into a chair and throwing back her curls at the maid, who stood, brush in hand, ready to arrange the luxuriant hair for the night.
"Do you know, Phoebe, I've heard some people say you and I are alike." "I have heard them say so too, my lady,"
said the girl quietly.
"But you must be very stupid to say it, for your ladyship is a beauty and I'm a poor, plain creature."
"Not at all, Phoebe,"
said the little lady superbly.
"You are like me, and your features are very nice. It is only color that you want. My hair is pale yellow, shot with gold, and yours is drab. My eyebrows and eyelashes are dark brown, and yours are almost, I scarcely like to say it, but they're almost white. My dear Phoebe, your complexion is sallow, and mine is pink and rosy. Why, with a bottle of hair dye, such as we see advertised in the papers, and a pot of rouge, you'd be as good-looking as I any day, Phoebe."
She prattled on in this way for a long time, talking of 100 frivolous subjects and ridiculing the people who she had met at the races for her maid's amusement. Her stepdaughter came into the dressing room to bid her good night and found the maid and mistress laughing aloud over one of the day's adventures. Alicia, who was never familiar with her servants, withdrew in disgust at my lady's frivolity.
"Go on brushing my hair, Phoebe,"
said Lady Audley every time the girl was almost going to complete her task.
"I quite enjoy a chat with you."
At last, just as she had dismissed her maid, she suddenly called her back.
"Phoebe Marks,"
she said,
"I want you to do me a favor."
"Yes, my lady."
"I want you to go to London to be the first train tomorrow morning to execute a little commission for me. You may take a day's holiday afterwards, as I know you have friends in town, and I shall give you a £5 note if you do what I want, and keep your own counsel about it."
"Yes, my lady."
"See that that door is securely shut, and come and sit on the stool at my feet."
The girl obeyed. Lady Audley smoothed her maid's neutral-tinted hair with her plump, white, and jeweled hand as she reflected for a few moments.
"And now listen, Phoebe. What I want you to do is very simple."
It was so simple that it was told in 5 minutes, and then Lady Audley retired into her bedroom and curled herself up cozily under the eiderdown quilt. She was a chilly little creature and loved to bury herself in a soft wrappings of satin and fur.
"Kiss me, Phoebe,"
she said as the girl arranged the cushions.
"I hear Sir Michael's step in the anteroom. You will meet him as you go out, and you may as well tell him that you are going up by the first train tomorrow morning to get my dress from Madame Frederick for the dinner at Morton Abbey."
It was late the next morning when Lady Audley went down to breakfast past 10 o'clock. While she was sipping her coffee, a servant brought her a scalded packet and a book for her to sign.
"Telegraph message,"
she cried, for the convenient word telegram had not yet been invented.
"What can be the matter?"
She looked up at her husband with wide open eyes, terrified, and seemed half afraid to break the seal. The envelope was addressed to Miss Lucy Graham at her Dawson's and had been sent on from the village. "Read it, my darling," he said, "and do not be alarmed. It may be nothing of any importance." It came from Miss Vincent, the schoolmistress to whom she had referred on entering Mr. Dawson's family. The lady was dangerously ill, and implored her old pupil to go and see her.
"Poor soul, she always meant to leave me her money,"
said Lucy with a mournful smile.
"She has never heard of the change in my fortunes. Dear Sir Michael, I must go to her."
"To be sure you must, dearest. If she was kind to my poor girl in her adversity, she has a claim upon her time and prosperity that shall never be forgotten. Put on your bonnet, Lucy. We shall be in time to catch the express."
"You will go with me?"
"Of course, my darling. Do you suppose I would let you go alone?"
"I was sure you would go with me,"
she said thoughtfully. "Does your friend send any address?"
No, but she always lived at Crescent Villa, West Brompton, and no doubt she lives there still.
There was only time for Lady Audley to hurry on her bonnet and shawl before she heard the carriage drive round the door and Sir Michael calling to her at the foot of the staircase. Her suite of rooms, as I have said, opened out to one another and terminated in an octagon antechamber, hung with well-oiled paintings. Even in her haste, she paused deliberately at the door of this room, double-locked it, and dropped the key into her pocket. This door, once locked, cut off all access to the lady's apartments.
And here, my dear listener, is where we will stop for today. Next week, we'll continue with Chapter 8. Next week, Dr. Kari Nixon will have more for you from the articles associated with this installment of Lady Audley's Secret. I hope you dash on over to Victorian Periodical Parade at Victorian Parade on Twitter and, you know, give us some likes, read our stuff. And there's some pictures there, too, associated with this reading. There's one of Lady Audley receiving the telegraph message that was here at the end. So you've seen that a couple times now when I posted Chapter 6 tweet. So you can see there Lord Audley sipping his tea and Lady Audley thinking about what on earth could this telegraph mean? And then they have the messenger that brought the message, which I don't think they named this time. They name everybody else except for this guy. Yeah, a servant. Yeah, so just a servant. That's too bad. Should we call him Scott? Scott the servant, delivering a telegraphic message. And then on Facebook, that's where we post pictures, and it's a cross-platform with Twitter. So, yeah, go and watch some of our past videos there. Click the bell and subscribe, and drop a like on this video if you enjoyed it. Share it with your friends if you think anybody you know will also enjoy it as much as you. I do enjoy making up voices for these characters, and I also like learning along the way as we go. I'm only reading in short spurts so that I'm not at the end by the third reading or whatever, so it's pretty nice, pretty interesting. Let me know what you think. Comments, feedback, everything is great. So have a great day, and don't miss Dr. Kari Nixon. Thanks. Bye.
Background music provided by Kevin MacLeod at Incomputech.com, such as Circus of Freaks, Darkling, Night Vigil, Morgana Rides, Magic Escape Room, Space Jazz, Foxtail Waltz, Starting Out Waltz, Allegretto, among others. Victorian Periodical Parade.